Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this week, as mentioned last week, for Barbieheimer week, we couldn't choose, so we are doing individual episodes dedicated to each film. First up, you are listening to our Barbie special. The iconic doll comes to the big screen and she can't stop thinking about dying. Hannah spoke to its director, Greta Gerwig, about making one of the year's biggest and pinkest cinema events. And for Film Club, we paired it with the young girls of Rochefort, all coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, I mean, it's a very strange week to be even kind of film biz adjacent. We've got two of like the big releases coming out at the same time. The actors are on strike and yeah, very uncertain times ahead. But worth mentioning that both this week and next week, the interviews were recorded before the strike. So like nobody's crossing a picket line in order to appear on Truth in Movies. I know, how are you guys feeling about this? We're going to have a really tough time with our jobs.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is going to be, how long does this kind of carry on for? Because obviously festival season is rapidly approaching and Venice, Toronto, Telluride and New York Film Festival are in very close succession. So if this drags on through July, August, September, then we could be looking at very different versions of those festivals, which I am kind of in favor of. I think that one of the annoying things about film festivals is that they kind of become this like platform for celebrity more than about the films. And although I like seeing all the celebrities alive in Venice on their boats, I do think it might be a bit easier to do our jobs on the ground if we're not having to contend with like hordes of Chalamet and Harry Styles fans like we have in previous years. So I don't know. I mean, obviously I am massively in favor of the strikes and my wish is just that the studios would kind of realize how much they're shooting themselves in the foot by letting this carry on, because they are the ones that are the problem here. It's, you know, no one wants to go on strike. No one like is like dying to do this. So, you know, they've kind of, as Fran Drescher was saying in the speech, like this was the last resort and they've like forced everyone's hand. So, you know, solidarity to them. And it must be boring as well, just being on strike all the time. So I fully sympathize with them and hope they get a fair deal.
Yeah, it is interesting how it pivoted when it went from just the writers to the writers and the actors, because, you know, all the signs are quite fun with the writers' strike. But now we're kind of getting a bit of theatre. We're getting a lot of clips of these guys like delivering some very passionate monologues.
Sean Gunn's monologue was very good, I have to say. And obviously, like, I mean, during the writers' strike, Christopher and Jonathan Nolan were like on the picket line in LA like quite early on in the strike, so you know, I think they would be fully in favor. Sorry, there's the cat is behind me like fully like worming across the floor. That's why I keep looking off to the side. Sorry about that. for regular listeners, I'm looking after a cat and he has decided this is the opportune moment to start doing the worm across the floor, which is very cute but quite distracting. But yeah, I mean, obviously the Nolans I believe would be fully in favor, and it's been interesting watching at the premiere. So all the stars been asked and they're all kind of saying, well, yeah, you know, this isn't fun for us, this is our lives, and the thing they're trying to safeguard is the future of cinema. If anyone listening hasn't read about what exactly it is people are taking issue with, it is pretty damning stuff that the studios are trying to bring in. That, you know, the idea that an actor can come in, work one day for $300 and then their likeness can be used indefinitely, that is like scary. That shouldn't, you know, that shouldn't even be a question. So,
and I love those little weird background actors. I don't want to live in a world world where you don't kind of see some kind of eccentric person making the most of their moment right at the back of the scene.
But maybe tomorrow when we talk about Oppenheimer, maybe let's not go into it now, but like it's kind of the antithesis of that idea of the oh, let's just airbrush a bunch of things into the background, or let's just CGI some buildings over there and change the weather and make everyone look smooth. You know, like interestingly with these two films, with regard to the strike, you guys might feel differently about this, or maybe I've got this all wrong, but like it feels like for a long time people have, that a lot of chips have been placed on these two films. And I don't know whether that's just some kind of strange pop cultural phenomenon that's happened because they're coming out at the same time and they're so different, or that actually there is some sort of like industry backing of this, and like, you know, that there is a real genuine need for films like this to do well. And it does strike me that, you know, both of these films we're going to be talking about, you know, over these two podcasts are very kind of, that, you know, they're not your kind of regular summer blockbuster, you know, bump that you know that we've maybe been seeing for the last sort of decade or so. They're very much kind of like, you know, they're more challenging, they've got a kind of, they're a bit more kind of outlier status, they're a bit more subversive. And I feel it would send a message to the studio bosses if these films did do well, of like exactly what they're going to be losing out on, all, you know, all this creative talent and making the films that people who are striking clearly want to be making are gonna lose. So but yeah, I think we're still in early days on it now, and you know, there's still the kind of backlog of quote unquote content that they're able to kind of prop themselves up on for a while. But like, it's gonna run out soon. Things are starting to get getting patchy, and we're gonna start seeing like weird reruns of films, and there's going to be like, you know, completely dead weeks, and films going to be in the cinemas for a long time with nobody actually seeing them. It's unfortunate, and you know, I do you know, we'll go deeper into them, but you know, I do hope that both these films do well. You know, I hope people flock to see them.
I think they will. I've had a lot of people kind of asking me about both. I think, you know, and the question is always kind of not which one, but like which order.
Yeah,
there's very few people in my life that are only interested in seeing one of these. But yeah, I mean, I'm the same with you. I mean, both of them, I kind of came out with the same feeling of just like, wow, that really wasn't what I was expecting, you know, and isn't that lovely?
I think, I mean, it's interesting because obviously Barbie has been so widely marketed. In fact, we've got a piece going up on The Oil Eyes about this today when we're recording, so it will already be up by the time people listen to this podcast. And the piece is comparing the marketing for Barbie with the marketing for Hayao Miyazaki's How Do You Live, which came out in Japan this past week and is going to come out at some point in the UK and the US, retitled The Boy and the Heron, which is upsetting because How Do You Live is like, goes hard as a title. But anyway, it was announced in June that they weren't going to do any marketing for that film beyond the poster that existed. And one of the producers said, I think deep down that's what audiences really want. And he kind of took a bit of a sly dig at Barbie and said, there's three trailers out for this big summer release, and if you watch them all, you've already seen the entire film. So I think it's interesting that we're seeing like three films that have been marketed in very, very different ways, but all have generated this huge amount of interest for various reasons. Like obviously with Barbie, it's obvious why people might be interested in that. Same with the Hayao Miyazaki film, same with Oppenheimer. But I'm very interested to hear the audience reactions and kind of if people feel that their expectations were met, and if they feel like it was essential to be in a cinema and see it first. Because that's why I love going to cinema, is because you want to be, you know, you want that moment where you're like, oh my God, I had no idea this is what was going to be there. And that does get lost if you have to wait for streaming to see something. So, you know, I've said this a lot this past week, but I'm so up for events, cinema coming back, and for that feeling of walking into the cinema and not knowing really what to expect and coming out just kind of like totally invigorated by it. And I definitely got that with Barbie. I haven't seen Oppenheimer at the time of recording, so I'm hoping for that similar feeling tonight.
And you're seeing it at the IMAX, I hope. It needs to be seen at the IMAX.
IMAX 70 mil. Can't wait. As intended, with the massive, massive IMAX print that I've been seeing pictures of everywhere, and thinking of those poor, poor projectionists having to try and load that up.
Well, I will try not to spoil it for you, but yeah, I mean, just I think it's kind of like worth addressing, because there has been kind of like a bit of a debate online that it kind of, in light of these strikes, like when it comes to things like Barbie and Oppenheimer, and people walking out of, you know, Oppenheimer, they literally left the actors left the premiere because like the strike had begun and they wanted to like go and join the picket lines. Our role in all of these things, because in a way, like David said, like if these films do well, that is good for the WGA and for SAG and like actually affords them more power. And we aren't part of the WGA, so we're not on strike. But like, I think it's a little grey. But I feel confident that we're not doing anything.
We did finally get clarification from SAG-AFTRA yesterday. They released a set of guidelines saying that critics should still be doing their job and should be working to highlight the films, but also to highlight the strikes and to just kind of like get the word out there about why the strike is important and why it isn't just rich people complaining about not getting enough money, which is like, that's not what it is at all. And I think there's this common misconception that like actors get paid a lot of money when really like there are some insane stories out there. One of the actresses from Orange is the New Black has been quoted quite widely. She's talked quite a lot about this, about the residuals on streaming and how little money you actually make. And I think Sydney Sweeney talked about this as well. Like she can't afford to take time off because she doesn't make enough money from acting, which is crazy for one of the kind of biggest actresses in the world right now to say that. So I see our role as critics very much as kind of holding the studios to account and yes, talking about the films, but also kind of keeping that pressure on in a way. And there's been some confusion around the term scab and what is and isn't scabbing. I would say that unless we are going to the studios and offering to work for them and offering to, I'll go and star in Gladiator too. Put me in Rids. I'll do it. I'll take Mescal's role. Unless that's happening, I think there needs to be some clarification, which luckily SAG-AFTRA have given finally to the journalists. They've given us this head note. So it's okay for you to be writing and reviewing. Just make sure you're showing some solidarity, I think.
Well, safe to say we've done that.
I hope so. I hope no one at home is sat listening to this going, wow, I'm not quite sure how the truth and movie these guys feel about these strikes.
But yeah, we should get on to the subject of this week's special episode. It's Barbie.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We'll receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
After being expelled from the utopian Barbie land for being a less than perfect doll, Barbie and Ken go on a journey of self-discovery together in the real world. But before we get into the film itself, here's Hannah talking to director Greta Gerwig.
Yeah, I don't know why that's not merch. That's
I can't believe that's people wouldn't want to wear
that. That's perfect merch. Well done. You should start an Etsy store.
Thank you. I've been thinking about it. You know, you've got to diversify in this economy. Journalism's not making it like
no,
it used to.
You gotta find
Etsy side hustle, Barbie. Yes,
exactly.
First of all, congratulations. Thank you. I love the film. I cried 3 times and remembered why I fell in love with Ryan Gosling when I was 14. So it was, a real journey for me.
Thank you.
I'm a huge fan of your past films as well. And I guess my first question is kind of how you view the relationship between Lady Bird, Little Women and Barbie. Mm. Do you see it as a kind of continuation of certain themes, or do you prefer, as some directors do, to just treat every single one as a kind of, that's a chapter closed, start a new thing?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think from inside myself, I see each thing as a distinct thing. Because I don't know, that's how I view it. And I kind of start each one as like it's its own universe. But then obviously, I think when I sort of step back and look at it, I'm like, well, I have some interests. I can see them all coalescing. But I don't actively sort of look for it. I think I tend to always just go towards what I'm curious about. And I think, there's obviously lots of ways on the surface that they're all different. But I think there's, I like women. I like women of different generations talking to each other. I mean, mothers and daughters, but also just across years. I think it's, I think there's been so much change for women in obviously the, 20th century, 21st century, and sort of the kind of conversation between a 90-year-old and a 20-year-old is pretty interesting to me. And I like dancing. I and musicals. I mean, like, those are more superficial things, but like, I've yet to make a movie where there's not some kind of a dance number in it, really.
I wanted to ask about that because obviously in your other films there are dance numbers, but this is definitely a major step
major
up.
Dance number.
Did you find that kind of working with such big bits of choreography and having to work out the story beats that you were trying to get across with these bits?
I loved it. It was like, it was my, the dance parts were my like sort of dream come true as a person who makes things on film, because it was just, I mean, I grew up dancing. I love dancing. And also for me, I think I knew movie musicals before I knew really movies. So that's another big part of my heart is, and used as inspirations for this movie, but, you know, Singing in the Rain and American in Paris and Oklahoma and Brigadoon and Gigi, like, they're all sort of fabulous and surreal. They have, like, a kind of surreal quality, Vincent Minnelli's musicals. And so I love all of that. And then when I was on the set and getting to kind of shoot these big dance numbers, it was kind of fulfilling some childhood love. Yeah.
Did you get any appreciation having then been through the experience of, oh, this is what it takes to get a dance sequence through?
I think a lot about actually those Busby Berkeley numbers. I think it's the number from like Gold Diggers of 1935. It's the craziest dance sequence. They're on these stairs. They're all wearing these like kind of sexy black pleather tops or something. It's just wild. So sometimes when you look at the costumes from the 30s, you're like, that's like properly risque. Like, those are wild costumes. And I mean, it must be 200 dancers and it's bananas. I mean, and I thought, how did he do that? How did he do any of that? So yeah, I definitely, it's something I think about. But I mean, I like dancers shown head to foot. Mm. I like seeing a full dancer body because I don't know, it's the way Fred Astaire liked to do it, and I don't think I know more than him.
Also, there's less places to hide when you're doing a kind of full body shot. You can't do the kind of black swan like close up for your camera trickery. You've got to.
I mean, we did do some coverage to tell the story, but I did like just letting them dance. I also find something very charming because obviously we had a lot of dancers who were professional dancers, but you know, all the actors could dance, but they are also just people dancing. And I find that quite winning.
Dancing's fun, you know. Yeah. I think especially Barbie, like when I was a kid, I would just, you know, be like, oh, my Barbies are having a party. They're all dancing. And, you know, kids don't know. Like, I didn't know proper dancing. So just kind of like, you know.
Let them go.
Let them go.
Yeah, exactly.
I know that you just mentioned Busby Berkeley. And also, I remember reading an interview where you were talking about Jacques Demy the kind of amazing color palettes in those films. And I can obviously see the very direct kind of spirit of those in Barbie. But what is it that kind of first captivated you about those specific, was about Busby Berkeley, about Demy? And when you were coming to formulating your ideas for Barbie, how did you feel those references could speak to what you envisioned?
Right. Well, they kind of have, they sort of live in different places. I mean, for the big grand Busby Berkeley things are, in a way, those are, they're about scale more than anything else. And they're about, obviously, he does all these wonderful, of the time, just like ingenious, I mean, they're of any time, really, but ingenious kind of ways of using the camera and kind of going in and coming out. And sort of like, I feel like a big thing he liked to do was like start with one and then go to like 150. But so that's sort of how I thought about, I mean, I thought about that more with like sort of the more top shots and the bigger kind of geographical geometric shapes. And then, I mean, Jacques Demy, certainly the colors, honestly, the way he lit all the colors, that was something Rodrigo and I looked at a lot, because the lighting is not maybe shaped as much as even the lighting that we have, but it's kind of it's the ability to stack colors on each other and not create strange color on faces, but it's sort of flat in a way, the lighting. And I think it allows the different colors to exist in the frame without fighting. So we were looking at that, and then another Jacques Tati, we did a lot of, I mean, obviously, like, we directly reference playtime, and then, but Mononcle, like, has those, even the way they move around that strange house, and they walk all the way across those steps, like, past this this little fountain that can't work, and then they come back. It's like this slow joke based on movement, which I thought a lot about when she's coming through her house and moving around her house, because it felt connected to that to me in some way. But I mean, I spend a lot of time looking at movies because, I mean, I love movies, but also it's just a constant reminder that, like, movies can be anything. You can invent anything. And there are so many different ways people have gone about it. And I think sometimes you can get a little, or I can get a little, like, movies must be this. And you're like, they could be whatever you want. You can make it up.
Exactly, yeah. That's why we're here, because of the infinite possibility that exists with a movie maker.
Yeah.
One, I think this is probably my final question. So one of the things I wanted to ask you was, obviously, I love the Indigo's reference and the Matchbox 20 reference.
Yeah.
And those felt very Greta. They felt very, like, drawn from your kind of, like, youth. How much did you kind of want to incorporate your own, like, experiences as a teenager?
Sure.
Obviously, like, Little Women and Lady Bird were very drawing a lot from your experience. Did you feel with this one you wanted to kind of still get those little personal touches in?
Yeah, always. I mean, I think, especially with this, I feel quite, making it personal is so important, because I think it can feel, especially when it's something like Barbie, which is a doll, a plastic doll.
The most corporate thing possible.
Yeah, and also totally impersonal. It's a product, you know. But, I mean, the truth is we spend our lives interacting with products. That's just true about us. We don't spend our lives, like, you know, living, you know, pure on organic farms. I mean, somebody does, but not me. And so whether it's, you know, pop songs or dolls or Kleenex, there's some emotion you have around it that's both like a kind of shared cultural thing, but also specific. And you know, I love this song. I mean, I love Closer to Final. I love Push. I mean, I was a top 40 radio girl when I was growing up, and like looking for the songs on the radio. And I think these things become almost like artifacts in our lives. And, you know, even the font we use for Barbie, like, this is the Barbie, this Barbie with the big bubble letters. That was the Barbie font that was on Barbie boxes when I was the age that was interested in Barbie. And I went back and forth on what font I wanted. And I was like, I want the one that meant something to me. I you know, because this is my Barbie movie, and this was my Barbie font. And it's a terrific looking font.
It's a great font. It's a very strong one. I love it.
I know. They've changed. They've gone back to the original Barbie script, which is very classy, you know, but I don't know. This one was mine.
I know. It was mine too. Yeah. You know, you never forget your Barbie. That's
the
thing.
Exactly. So I'm like, well, this one's mine. Somebody else can make a different one.
Thank you so much.
You.
And also, thank you for the Midge representation, because I had that.
Midge. Midge. So,
Hannah, I mean, I love that kind of, like, we kind of knew we were going to do these two special episodes, and then it was like divided up who gets one. There wasn't a moment of hesitation. It was kind of clear I was going to do Oppenheimer and you were going to do Barbie.
Yeah. So for a little while, it looked like we might get to talk to Ryan Gosling. And as I have been obsessed with Ryan Gosling since I was like 13, 14, I saw Half Nelson and it was like a weird film for a 13-year-old to be like, yeah, this is my guy. But I love Ryan Gosling and I was so excited for him to do another comedy because it's been so long. We've been really out in the trenches waiting for him to be allowed to be funny again. And anyone that saw The Grey Man will attest to like the hard times we've had as Gosling fans. So I was very much like staking my claim early, and obviously getting to speak to Greta again was amazing. And I think I was saying this last night at the screening to someone, she's just such a fan of movies and a lover of movies. And when you strip back all this like discourse around, oh, capitalism, oh, Barbie, oh, whatever, she's just a big nerd who loves cinema and loves musicals and is so earnest about that. And like, you get her talking about Busby Berkeley or Jacques Demy or even Jack Tati, who she cited as an influence on this film, like, she just can go for hours. There's an amazing video that Letterboxd did, an interview with her actually, where she's talking through the inspirations behind Barbie, and she's talking about just the array of films she's citing, All That Jazz and New York, New York, and the Gold Diggers of
1933.
The Gold Diggers have not. I always get the number mixed up. I'm really showing my like disnumerate brain. This is why I love film so much, because I don't have to do any maths. But anyway, yeah, she just loves movies so much, and I feel like that's actually something that has been lost in all this, maybe, or that people don't believe about this. They don't think is sincere, is that she has just kind of exploded her love of cinema in this film. Like, you know, it's like you can see all the things she's talking about, all the references, and even the unintentional ones. I think like that is what surprised me most about the film, is that it sincerely feels like it was made by someone who just loves making a spectacle and giving you things to look at and pulling these cinematic references in and really creating something that you watch it and you are totally absorbed by it. And I think that's kind of what was most rewarding about the film to me.
Yeah, I mean, the atmosphere at that screening last night was so good. Everyone was wearing pink. People were losing their minds on my row. I had friends basically doing like the Hunger Games to get my plus one, I gotta say. And yeah, even with kind of, you know, the three trailers that came out and clips coming out of like, you know, Ryan singing his song, like I didn't feel prepared. Like, David, was it what you were expecting?
No, I'd been I've got to say, even with the trailers, I was still in a bit of a kind of, yeah, grey zone as to what actually the film was going to be. And Hannah had been to see it before me, and I'd asked her some, you know, strategic questions about it without trying to sort of spoil it. But even then, I was just like, I'm still not quite sure what this is. Because, yeah, you had this array of references. You had all these actors. You had these trailers with that were sort of very, very sort of sunny and sparkly and playing into the kind of mythos of Barbie. And then it hits you with this line: "Do you ever think about dying?" And you know, you kind of thinking, "Oh my God, where is this going to go?" And I think the turning point for me was when, because I've got a 5-year-old daughter who's really into Barbie, and she's been seeing the trailers for it at the front of other films, and she's been seeing all the advertising, and she has been kind of Barbie pilled big time. Just every time we see any advertising for Barbie, she has to point it out and says, "Can we go and see that?" And I have to say, I'm waiting to hear what the certificate's going to be to see if I'm legally allowed to take you. So when it was kind of quietly announced that it was going to be a 12A, I was disappointed, because I was really looking forward to taking her to see it. But I think, having seen the film now, I understand. And I think that, you know, trying to make this as little spoilery as possible. I think that one of the things that the film is actually dealing with is less to do with like the sort of nostalgic element of how Barbies are toys for kids and girls, and it does deal with that in the beginning, and says how that it's, you know, they're making this kind of somewhat weak attempt to give this kind of liberal worldview and give young girls this kind of aspirational vision of all the things they could be, and normalizing all types of bodies, and they make a joke about, and that's why liberal feminism has been completed, and you know, everybody in the world is happy. And it's more about like the Greta Gerwig herself looking at what they mean to her as an adult, and thinking back about like not only did they shape my youth, but how did they shape my relationship to my family and my friends, and what I thought about guys, and what I thought about girlfriends. And you know, like, I think some of the most kind of effective moments are with the mother and daughter played by America Ferrara and Ariana Greenblatt, who Barbie hooks up with when she kind of goes over to the real world, which, you know, no, that's not a spoiler because that's in the trailer. And yeah, like, I found that their relationship and how it plays out and the discussions they have about what this toy kind of means to them both is actually really moving. And America Ferrara's character ends up being the kind of the sort of feminist mouthpiece, bringing the kind of real world West Coast vision of feminism to Barbie land in the end. So yeah, it was surprising to me. So I guess going back to your original question, yes, I was surprised that there's basically kind of dense feminist tracts being cited. That, you know, that I think not only has Greta Gerwig been doing her homework with movies, she's been reading her kind of feminist philosophy, like, you know, 20th century feminist philosophy, and like, you know, your Betty Friedans, your Susan Sontags, and you know, I think all of that's, you know, she's dealing with that stuff in this film, and that's kind of what brings the subversive element to it, I think.
Not only that, she's talking about Proust. Like, I've seen it twice now, and I think the first time that kind of washed over me a bit, because there's a moment where Barbie makes a reference. She says, oh, I'm getting real Proustian flashbacks. And Will Ferrell, who is the CEO of Mattel, says, oh, remember Proust, Barbie? That didn't sell well. But actually, like, the more I thought about it this time, I was like, wow, she's basically like citing In Search of Lost Time in this film, and like talking about the loss of youth and the loss of kind of innocence and how memory works. Like, there's some I think one of the most kind of powerful moments in the film is Barbie's, but Margot, I mean, I feel like saying Barbie, it's like there's so many Barbies, but Margot Robbie's Barbie remembering kind of her relationship to America Ferrera and Ariana Greenblatt's characters. And it reminded me a little bit of Toy Story 2 with the whole the Jessie when she loved me scene. I think this is kind of maybe a little bit less emotionally devastating than that was to 8-year-old me, but yeah, it's surprising how much kind of deep cut philosophy Greta's getting in there. For I mean, maybe that's also like Noah Baumbach's influence. Like, he seems like he would be a Proust head.
Yeah, it kind of like feels like a very basic thing whenever you're like watching a film to be like, who is this for? And like, that's normally a criticism, but like, I was, you know, my daughter's really excited about this film. I have no idea what I'm going to do at this point, but I was kind of sat down and within like 15 minutes, I was like, oh no, this is like directly aimed at me, philosophy nerd who gets sad and watches the BBC remake of Pride and Prejudice on loop. Like, this is a, you know, like, as something that is kind of essentially like Mattel IP, and like the marketing of this has been absolutely insane. It really feels very uncynical.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's so earnest, and that won't work for everyone. And I'm sure that there will be a lot of kind of criticisms that come out. But I mean, that's kind of how I see Greta's filmmaking. Like, I mean, I think about Lady Bird and I think about Little Women. They are profoundly earnest films and hopeful films as well. And I mean, sad in many ways. They're both very sad films. And this, I think, is a sad film at times. But yeah, I guess like there's just something so deeply rooted in the kind of like there's this line in the film where America Ferrera says, even if you can't make it perfect, you can make it better. And that really, like, that to me is kind of Greta's like philosophy with filmmaking. There's been all this talk about how apparently she wants to be a big studio filmmaker, and a lot of people have been interpreting that as like, oh, she wants to make IP films, she wants to make Marvel movies. And I don't think it's that.
Hannah, this is an IP film. Like, no, we cannot pretend.
Yeah, but no, I'm not pretending it's like an indie film, but you know, like, I think like there's a difference between working within the kind of system that exists to make films like this and working only like as a kind of, you know, a gun for hire doing like action movies that all kind of feel the same. This does feel like it has a fingerprint, you know. It doesn't feel like it's a movie made by committee, and there are weird things in it and some choices that I don't think quite work. And I've said to everyone I've seen, like, who's asked me about it, I'm like, oh, it's not a perfect movie, but I think it is a very human movie. And like, for a Barbie movie to feel like it actually has a kind of soul is kind of like, oh, I you know, I was very skeptical that she would be able to kind of walk that tightrope. It's not an easy tightrope to walk. And I mean, the big problem is, now are studios going to embrace the kind of positive things about this film, i.e. giving a filmmaker budget and time and resources to make film they want to make, or are they going to take the negative, which is IP, and they're just going to assume, as we saw from that New Yorker article a few weeks, oh well, now we should just make a film about every single toy that Mattel's ever had, because everyone wants to see an 8-Ball movie and a Barney movie and a, I don't know, Uno Extreme movie. Like, you know, like they're just taking kind of all the wrong lessons is what I fear.
Yeah, I mean, it is worrying. I do feel that is kind of something I worried about also with like Top Gun Maverick, where it's just like, they're like, they love nostalgia, let's do lots more of that. We worry. But
sorry, I guess that's also like kind of why the strike thing is so interesting, happening at the same time as this, because I think the way that big studios and big CEOs and the people that crunch the numbers would have it is that they can make films like Barbie, but just not involve any of the creative talent behind it. They can just, like, you know, but via some magic algorithm, they can shit out a film about, I don't know, backgammon, and it'll be like an instant best, you know, everyone will want to go and watch it. Whereas like, what we're seeing is the people that are creating these movies we love can't afford to make the movie. movies. Like, they, you know, that they're just trying to continue doing what they love. And I think that is kind of, you know, what I keep coming back to about this particular moment in time is that, like, I am a hopeless optimist when it comes to filmmaking. I know a lot of people are a lot more cynical than I am about the state of movies and about the future of movies. But I don't know, it's hard for me to watch something like Barbie and for me to live in a moment where people are genuinely very excited about going to the cinema this summer and feel kind of like, oh, the end is nigh. I think, you know, the appetites are still there and the creative voices are still there. It's just kind of whether or not the studios are going to run it completely into the ground.
Well, they've spoken like a true person who hasn't seen Oppenheimer.
I'm going to come on tomorrow and be like, there is no hope. We're all doomed.
But I can't believe that we haven't spoken about the Kens yet. David, the Kens.
The Kens. Wow.
What is the Kens?
The film kind of opens introducing us to the notion that, as Hannah alluded to just before, Margot Robbie plays Barbie, but there's also all the different variations of Barbie are also named Barbie with their little kind of precursor. So, you know, you have Nobel Prize Barbie and, you know, Dr. Barbie, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have kind of similar deal with the Kens, although the Kens seem a little bit more homogenized. Their sort of like delineations are a bit more kind of like beach Ken or active Ken or, you know, but they all seem a bit more much of a muchness. And like the idea is that they're introduced and all they do is kind of pine for the Barbies. You know, they're completely subservient, and you know that is kind of flipped on its head. And at the center of it all is Ryan Gosling as the main Ken, who has got his kind of white bleach blonde hair. And I mean, I couldn't tell if he had some sort of like chest enhancing plastic or those were his actual pecs, but they were the definition of his chest, which is kind of visible for the majority of the film. It's like looking at a kind of Escher painting. It's like, wow, I don't understand, you know.
I think some contour was probably involved, was my guess.
I imagine some
as well as, you know, exercise.
It's not, you know, outside the realm of possibility of him looking like that. As anyone who has seen Crazy Stupid Love will remember the very famous Photoshop scene where Emma Stone sees his abs and says, "It's like you're fucking photoshopped," which lives in my mind for eternity. You know, he looked great, I think, is what we all need to remember here. But yeah, I'm in very heavy spray tan going on there.
Yeah. Yeah, he was kind of, yeah, he had that kind of, you know, airbrushed vibe to him, which is kind of part of his character. Ryan Gosling is someone who, there are not a lot of mainstream actors who could play that role the way that he has played it. And, you know, he's gone all in on it is something of an understatement. I mean, it's a full on singing, dancing, self-depreciatory like riot. You know, he's the butt of most of the jokes in the film. He's kind of absurd and sweet and charming and idiotic. And, you know, I think there's a sort of riff near the end, which I won't really go into, but you know, where the Kens kind of get some comeuppance for a thing they've done. And it's a very, very sort of funny, you know, using them as the kind of butt of all these kind of quite funny, quite sort of pop culturally feminist gags that are quite, so they're very sort of like, you know, they're not of the sort of academic feminist strand, which has been sort of dealt with before, but like more sort of, you know, observational comedy about sort of the male ego. And
all things that have happened to me, basically.
Yeah.
I gotta say. Yeah. Acoustic guitar and all.
Yeah, I think that that's gonna be very relatable for a lot of people watching the film. But yeah, I mean, it's like, I think one thing worth addressing via the Kens is that, so last night at this screening, as you said, it was mayhem, and we were sort of stood behind this group of people, and there was this guy, and he was sort of like, "Don't tell anyone I'm here for Barbie," you know, I think sort of jokingly, but it was a sort of like shy, you know, there is sort of shy Barbie fans, you know, there's like, are men gonna find it tough seeing this film, you know, that is it a film for women, by women, about women? And you know, I would say definitely not. I mean, it's like, although it is dealing with this kind of, you know, feminist theory in a lot of it, I mean, it's, you know, I don't think that the male viewers are necessarily going to feel like, I mean, and in a good way, I feel that like one of the things it's doing is also sort of mocking this kind of this culture of like incel and Andrew Tate men's rights activist types. And I'd be interested to see how the kind of, you know, the conservative commentariat in America take this film. I kind of feel like, do you remember when they went absolutely wild over WAP? I kind of feel that this
sadly told on themselves, yeah.
a similar thing, because it's not only is it kind of like dealing with all the very kind of overt liberal feminism, but it's also very, very critical of this new brand of kind of, you know, male influencer, men's rights and all this kind of stuff, like, you know, pro-patriarchy, revolting Andrew Tate awfulness type things, which kind of can skews a little bit towards in the end. So, yeah, anyone can go and see it and enjoy it, I think. It's not just the kind of a film for women, I think, a women's picture.
Yeah, I mean, I was just really impressed by Margot Robbie and Ryan Gosling in terms of, like, physical comedy. I mean, I think they really, like, hold their own against your sort of Will Ferrell, Kate McKinnons, who are, you know, better known for that. Like, some of Ryan's moments were just so small, just kind of, like, moving an arm, and I was just in absolute stitches. Yeah, I haven't laughed this much in a really long time, which was nice after Oppenheimer. No spoilers for Oppenheimer, but yeah.
I know. I'm not going to be laughing very much on Oppenheimer.
Well, I mean, some of the cameos you might, not to get into the next episode.
One thing I would say about Barbie very quickly, because I feel that, like, as much as I enjoyed the film, and I don't necessarily, I'm sort of like, I'm not sure if this is necessarily a criticism of the film, but, like, in terms of, like, its structure and its narrative and what's, you know, the sort of logic behind what's happening, it's very chaotic. I mean, I don't think it's chaotic to the point that it's to the detriment of the film, because it's kind of operating on this more sort of sketchy, instant relief level. But, like, you know, there's bits that kind of, and sort of character arcs that just don't really make sense. And I have to say, like, maybe chalk it up to this kind of, you know, slightly sort of surrealist element, experimental element to the film. But, like, I'm not actually sure, like, what the film was about in the end. Like, not what it was about. I think I know what it was about, but I'm not sure what the story was. I find it very hard explaining the narrative and how it kind of comes together to form a kind of coherent whole. But at the same time, I think we've had enough of those films that are kind of very kind of primped, packaged, and done in a very in a way that where they've been kind of noted to death. And, you know, it's enjoyable to have a film that is this kind of, it is chaotic in a very enjoyable way.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't make any sense of the ending. I loved the actual, obviously, final moment, but final 15 minutes, it was just a case of, like, you know what, just relax. You know, she's given you a great time so far. Like, you know, just stay with her for the landing. It's okay. Well, I mean, like, obviously, that screening was absolutely wonderful, and we were a pink army coming out in support of cinema, but we should do some scores, hopefully not too biased by how good the vibes were. Hannah, you've seen it twice, so do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I mean, anticipation is a difficult one, because I was very excited about this, but also, like, I did have that thing in the back of my mind of, like, am I setting myself up for a fall here? And also, like, the third feature, I think, sometimes can be the trickiest one for directors. But I think a 4 is probably fair, maybe a 4.5. I don't think it was a 5, because I did have those a few doubts in the back of my mind. Enjoyment, I think probably a 5. The first time I saw it, I cried 3 times. And as I said, like, as a Ryan Gosling fan, this is, like, all my Christmases come at once. I do think he really, like, Margot Robbie's fantastic, but I think, yeah, Ryan just kind of, he operates on a different plane of existence when it comes to comedy, as anyone who has seen The Nice Guys will attest. He's just a really wonderful comedic presence. And then in retrospect, I think it's a 4. I think there's definitely flaws, and there are things that I don't think necessarily work, or that kind of feel a little bit rushed, weirdly. Like, the editing is very choppy. There's one character that just straight up is never introduced, but is, like, kind of there in scenes, and you're like, but yeah, I mean, I still think it's wonderful, but a 4 5 4 would be where I'm landing on it.
very reasonable. I'm just going to copy that. That was exactly how I felt as well. but David, it's up to you to kind of like subvert the 4-5-4.
I'm probably going to go 4-4-4. I thought it was like, you know, I was kind of super intrigued by it. Maybe it was 5-4-4, because I do think that like Little Women was like maybe my favorite film of that year. So like, you know, I didn't love Lady Bird, but I loved Little Women, and I was like, wow, she's an incredible director. What is she going to bring to this? But then, yeah, I think it would be impossible to live up to all the marketing and hype and, you know, and the expectation. And it's a weird film. It's a weird, fragile, idiosyncratic blockbuster that has lots of amazing stuff in it, it's slightly all over the place. And, you know, I don't necessarily think I'm going to try and, you know, I think I'll probably see it again with my daughter, like relatively soonish. But I think 5 is maybe a little bit too young. So yeah, 4's across the board for me.
Yeah. I've got the same pressure, because it's like, and I'm hoping they just kind of enjoy the aesthetic and don't get too kind of caught up in the existential dread. But yeah, let me know how it goes for you.
I wonder if the box office initially is not as up to the scratch. They do actually release a PG cut so they can get the kiddie quotient in for the summer holidays. I mean, that's a gold mine right there that they're leaving covered up. So, you know, your call, Zaslav.
Yeah, and then they'd have to change the final scene, and that would be sad.
Yeah.
I don't think they would. I think that anyone, because it's 12A over here, I think that a lot of parents will just take their younger kids. I think 7 and up, you'd probably be fine with it.
Yeah.
I mean, it all depends on
how, 7.
Yeah.
That doesn't help us, Hannah.
I'm just telling the listeners. I think, yeah, I don't think you could cut all the stuff out that makes it a 12A and it still be the same film. I mean, there are also plenty of Barbie movies out there if you want your child to watch a Barbie movie. Barbie Life in the Dream House is on Netflix. It's great. It's really funny. And it has a very similar vibe. And I wish I'd asked Greta if she'd seen it, because I think she did.
There is a surprisingly good episode of Barbie that explained white privilege really well to my daughter at like 5, and she just got it. So yeah, Barbie's been doing some good work for a while. But yeah, we should move on to Film Club. It's the Young Girls of Rochefort.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Twin sisters Delphine and Solange really realize their dream of working for the stage when they are discovered by a couple associated with a carnival and find love in the process. So David, this was your call. Why did you decide to pair Barbie with this film?
Oh, well, two reasons. I think I'd heard, read somewhere that, you know, Greta Gerwig had been influenced by Jacques Demy. And I kind of thought, full disclosure, this is like one of, if not my favorite film of all time. And probably one of the films I've seen the most times ever. When it came out on Blu-ray a couple of years ago, and I recorded a commentary for it, and I ended up watching it like, I mean, I guess it's a bit of a cheat, but I ended up watching it like 12 times in a month. And even that, I was still, I've still watched it again since because that's how much I enjoy it. I think this was a film that I originally ended up watching on the back of the 2002 Sight and Sound poll and just seeing it crop up in a couple of votes and not really knowing anything about it. Like, more people had voted for Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which is kind of his most, his more famous film. And this film actually was when it came out, it was a bit of a bomb, especially in America. Cause I think, Pauline Kael wrote a very negative review of it, saying it was this kind of like, you know, homage to American musicals, and it was done really badly, and the dancing was awful. It didn't, and it was all kind of wishy washy and tonally all over the place. And I mean, so basically, to précis the film, it's about a group of traveling motorcycle and boat sales, like marketing salesmen, who travel around French cities. This is a very French 60s thing. They travel around French cities and they do these kind of commercial carnivals where they have all these stalls where you can look at boats and motorbikes and cars and things. And they do songs and dances around them. And they're doing one in the town square of Rochefort, which is in kind of like southwestern France. And you have these twins, and you have these two guys who are kind of coming through in the carnival, and they meet, and it's kind of this sort of like very Shakespearean kind of rondelay of like misconnections and people looking for their true loves and trying to meet people. And then Gene Kelly turns up as this composer who is looking for his feminine ideal, and he sees a portrait of her in a picture gallery and says, "Who's that?" And she's like, "Oh, it's a girl who lives here." And they kind of bump into each other, and it's this very kind of like fanciful fairy tale film with incredible songs by Michel Legrand. And you know, I love it for a billion reasons, but I think one of the reasons why it's maybe a good choice for Film Club, that tonally too, it's got these kind of very strange undercurrents of like, there's like a mass murderer who's like at large during the whole film that they're kind of referring to, and there's this kind of conceptual artist who does these really weird aggressive paintings where he shoots paint onto a canvas, and you know, there's all these questions about like, you know, deadbeat dads, and you know, like women who've just been left to sort of, you know, squander their lives working at kind of food concessions. And yeah, it's kind of a film that deals with these quite difficult social subjects. I think all of Jacques Demy's films do that. They're kind of like smuggling in this kind of very trenchant and of the era political discourse into these like magical fairy tale musicals that they give you the kind of bliss of seeing like pastel clothes and amazing jazzy dance numbers, but also you've got this kind of real sense of like, oh yeah, this stuff is happening. And yeah, and it's all set to this kind of ticking clock, and as the days go by, and you know that the carnival is going to leave town, and when it does, it's like this, you know, it's not necessarily sad what happens to the characters, but it's sad in the end that all the characters have to kind of leave and go their separate ways. And it's done in this really kind of melancholy way. But yeah, just, you know, I think we picked it before seeing Barbie, but having seen Barbie, I can definitely see there's some overlap there. But maybe having seen Barbie, there are some, like my colleague Adam was telling me this morning that he would have picked The Matrix as the film club. Because it's like the red pill, blue pill bit, and then you've got the, you know, meeting the creator, and you know, like it's there's a whole bit in a white space. Yeah, yeah. There's a whole load of stuff that he
it does make sense.
Yeah, they picked up on, and it's Warner Brothers IP, so she could have raided that. So sorry, I've rabbited on a long time there, but
no, it's true. Once you kind of see Barbie, it's like Bader-Meinhof effect. You kind of start seeing it everywhere.
Well, I think it's, I mean, Greta has said as well, like the influences are very far reaching. Like in the Letterboxd piece, she talks about the Truman Show, and there's a lovely bit where she talks about how Peter Weir and her had a long phone conversation because she was very inspired by the look of the Truman Show and kind of that artificial artificiality that is in the film. And Peter Weir was saying, yeah, well, we shot all that outside, but we hung up lights to make it look more artificial and it made it really hot, so don't do that. And just the idea of those two kind of chatting, you know, chatting shop on the phone is very charming. I had not seen The Young Girls of Rochefort before. I had seen The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and I really liked that. But I think we did that for a previous film club, which is why we kind of thought we'd do this one instead. And I do think I now understand, like, La La Land a lot better, having now watched this film. And I just feel like Damien Chazelle really, like, ripped that off wholesale. Like, the whole, like, opening of La La Land, the kind of recurring, like, musical little, like, I forget the name, like, for like a riff, there's like a fancy French name,
motif.
Yeah, I mean, I was just like, wow. I mean, it kind of made me dislike La La Land, a film I otherwise quite like, because I was like, oh, he did just like rip off this this musical from the 60s. But I do think Umbrellas of Cherbourg is better, having now seen them both. I think, yeah. I like the kind of the sad ending in Umbrellas of Cherbourg, whereas this is like more hopeful, more kind of Hollywood, which is, I mean, it was his big homage to like Hollywood grand musicals, wasn't it? So
yeah, it's a movie that loves movies.
There's a lot of those going around at the moment.
But yeah, we should wrap up because, you know, people may get sick of us because they are getting two episodes this week. But yes, shall we do our non-movie recommendations to finish? David, do you want to go first? Not that people have time because okay. They've got to see.
There's so much
like,
to
there's
see.
At least like 5 hours of essential viewing and then, you know. And then some.
Okay, I'm very late to the party on this, and apologies if someone else has already done this in the past, but I'm going to say a show called Poker Face, written and largely directed by Rian Johnson, Natasha Lyonne starring riff on the detective serial Columbo. Yeah, and I don't watch much TV. I watch very, very, very little TV, in fact. And I think the one thing that I might watch is the Bear, just because so many separate people have recommended that to me. So The Bear maybe incoming, but I ended up watching Poker Face for similar reasons, and just had a really good time with it. It's light. It doesn't take itself too seriously. It's quite wacky, and you know the situations are kind of unbelievable. It's got a kind of do you guys know what I mean by like a Midsummer Murders vibe?
Like sort
of
yes.
Something quite absurd about the fact that, you know, there's so many murders happening in this sort of sleepy village. Well, you know, you're sort of like, how can one woman be involved? on the sideline to so many like brutal slayings? But yeah, it's done in a very sort of tongue-in-cheek and charming way, and Natasha Lyonne is great, and you know Rian Johnson obviously has put in some serious kind of quality control on it, and it's shot in a very sort of cinematic way as well, so yeah, very enjoyable.
Yeah, I gotta say Poker Face is one, and The Bear actually are ones that I am kind of saving for the TV Siberia that awaits us because of recent events. Yeah, so November, I think, is where I'm going to save that for. Hannah, what about you? What is your rec?
My recommendation is Barbie related. So I think I may have mentioned, in fact, yeah, I definitely mentioned this to Saskia because Saskia, friend of the podcast who was on our Smoking Causes Coughing / Elemental episode and wrote an article recently about Barbie for the website for a little while I was online. It's a really good article to going through kind of parodies of Barbie across history. And a show I mentioned to her is like a web series from the mid 2000s called The Most Popular Girls in School that I used to watch. And it's basically stop motion Barbies voiced by this group of guys and some like niche internet celebrities of the time. And it's just about a clique of cheerleaders at a Kansas high school and their kind of foul-mouthed, increasingly ridiculous conflicts that they get into. There's like a teen pregnancy. There's a hipsters versus cheerleaders like battle that goes on. It's really, really silly and really ridiculous. And in some places just like very, very much of its time in terms of humor and the jokes they're making, which is a polite way of saying there are a lot of slurs in it that I very much do not approve of, and very much, you know, you're kind of like, oh wow, this was only 10 years ago and people openly felt like they could say this kind of stuff with their whole chest. But there's a lot of good stuff in there too. There's a very funny joke about Pearl Harbor, the film, that like I keep thinking about where
oh god, thank goodness you said the film at the end of that sentence.
Yeah, on theme with Oppenheimer. No, the film.
the film version of Pearl Harbor, a very funny reference to that, where they're comparing like Ben Affleck and Cuba Gooding Jr. in that film, which is it's very funny. So very of its time. So don't. Every episode is not a winner, but the ones that are good are so good, and they're only like eight minutes an episode. So if you're just kind of on your lunch break and looking for something to pass the time, it's one of those odd curios where I can't believe these guys kind of didn't go on to do big things, because it's so inventive. It's very like Robot Chicken, if any listeners are kind of familiar with that Adult Swim show by Seth Green, where it's kind of all the same thing: Barbies and action figures and improvised sets, and it's just I think it's just really fun and really creative. And watching Barbie, it did remind me a lot of the way, you know, as an adult you kind of pick up these toys and you're like, oh yeah, I used to play with this, and it's just good fun.
That does sound great. I mean, maybe that'll be what I do on the bus in between going to rewatch all of these things.
Perfect length for a bus ride.
If you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next up, you may think about Dying Barbie, but Oppenheimer is about to become Death, the Destroyer of Worlds. Hannah and David will be back in a couple of days to discuss Christopher Nolan's latest on an Oppenheimer special, and I spoke to its star, the incredible Cillian Murphy. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Layla Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.